This episode is brought to you by Groove Washer, the best record cleaners and protective sleeves for your vinyl collection. Ask for the Groove Washer from your local shop or go to groovewasher.com. Discount code VinylGuide10. And now, on with the show.
Well, hey everyone, it's Nate. Welcome to episode 371 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. And today, we are welcoming Joel Selvin, renowned writer and music critic of the San Francisco Chronicle for over 30 years, author and co-author of many rock books and biographies. I mean, Joel has been an outstanding member of the Bay Area music scene since the late 60s, where he not only lived through the summer of love, he met, socialized, and in many cases, befriended the musicians and artists of the day. Now, Joel has written multiple books on various rock personalities and events, including Altamont, Haight-Ashbury, The Summer of Love, as well as working with the likes of Sammy Hagar, L.A. Reid, and Dave Mustaine on their literary projects. But folks, we are gathered here today to talk to the esteemed Mr. Selvin about vinyl, record collecting, and Sly and the Family Stone, an act that in most critical opinions doesn't get the recognition they are due. Sly Stone was undoubtedly a musical genius and had a long track record of producing hits long before he came into the national consciousness. But his popularity brought on a drug habit and a social circle that not only cratered his career, it scarred those close to Sly Stone for the rest of their lives. But now you could learn more about Sly and the Family Stone from a safe distance by reading Joel's book, Sly and the Family Stone, An Oral History. And peoples, I gotta say, this is a harrowing book, a definite page-turner. And you can get Joel's Sly and the Family Stone book at your favorite bookshop or order a Kindle version and start enjoying it immediately. And by the way, if you like this interview, there is an extended version, commercial-free and high-resolution at patreon.com/vinylguide. Get early access to all interviews, extra interviews, plus more content, more music, more nerd facts, all commercial-free and high-resolution at patreon.com/vinylguide. Plus, you get the warm, fuzzy feeling that you're helping keep this podcast going and keeping me supplied with beers and burritos. That's patreon.com/vinylguide, and thanks in advance for your support. And with that done, let's talk to Mr. Joel Selvin all about the many triumphs and tragedies of Sly and the Family Stone.
Am I there?
I don't know. Are you?
Oh, I know. I got to turn on the video. That's it.
How are you today, Joel?
Today is a good day.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'm grooving. I'm getting work done.
All right, Joel, thank you so much for joining us here on The Vinyl Guide. Look, I've read many of your books, and to me, you're a bit of a hometown hero. I grew up in the Bay Area, so being extra familiar with your work for many, many years, it's a privilege to have you on the show, mate.
Always good to have a Chronicle subscriber in the house.
I didn't say I subscribed. No, but I grew up in the Bay Area, you know, very familiar with your work, and I want to spend some time certainly going through the reissue of this Sly and the Family Stone book. It's one of those books, Joel, to where I pick it up and I just start reading it. I think maybe I'll do it for 10 minutes to help me go to bed. And 2 hours later, I'm still going through it. I got to find out what happens with this dog. I got to find out what happens with all these characters. It's such a white knuckle ride. And I'm so glad this book is coming back into print.
Thank you. I don't recommend it as nighttime reading.
No, I learned that the hard way. I mean, just the tales of squandered genius and everything, the twists and turns. Anyway, look, it's part musical documentary, part drama, part war epic. So I do want to spend some time getting plenty into that because I've got lots of questions. But first off, our show has a lot to do with vinyl and collectability and records and whatnot. And I believe I'm viewing right now the basement record library. Is that right?
Correct.
Excellent. And describe your record collection.
There's about 25,000 albums. There's about 15,000 45s. There's about 10,000 CDs. There's a massive book library because you know, all those years of getting review copies in the mail, I didn't keep all the records. I kept all the books. So I have like 5,000 volumes on pop music.
Wow.
And, you know, I live in a library. It's you know, let's see. Let's just get a handful here and see what's on the floor. Let's see. We've got a nice
Pet Sounds
1966 mono pressing of Pet Sounds. This is the test pressing for the original Blood on the Tracks. This is Ken Kesey and the Grateful Dead in the studio. We all know this one.
Yes. That's you a know? UK RU experience, right?
Yeah, that's that. And then, you know, that's J.D. Souther and Glenn Frey. And there's a good Buffalo Springfield. You know, I mean, you know, I like records. What can I say?
Yeah, I can see. So in terms of the your records, you've got a lot of promos you've kept throughout the years. I mean, you've been doing this since the late 60s. So are you a bit of a pack rat in that way?
Well, you know, I kept a lot of the records and I had enough intelligence to keep most of the right ones. You know, I still remember, oh, yeah, I had that record. Why didn't I keep it? But I do still remember the first reviewer service package that came to me at college where I was on a school newspaper. And it was I Never Found a Girl by Eddie Floyd and Soul Folk in Action by the Staple Singers coming to me from Stax Bolt in Memphis. You know, it was like to enter into the kingdom of heaven on earth to have the new records sent to you in the mail the day they were released. It was amazing. Man, I remember getting the White Album and taking it over to this campus radio station because they hadn't gotten their copy yet.
That's magic. I mean, that's you must have just said, of all the luck, I'm now getting free music before
everyone. Yeah, concert tickets, and no, then people started paying me to do this. I mean, it was all pretty hilarious at my youthful age to get into that stuff. It was just, it's like given the key to the candy store.
So you were right in the middle of the San Francisco music scene in the late 60s. What sort of important shows did you see? You were getting let into all these things. What are some of the more memorable ones?
Well, I wouldn't know where to stop with this, you know? I mean, Butterfield at the Fillmore in 66, Cream, Hendrix, Zeppelin at the Fillmore, Otis Redding at Basin Street West, Creedence Clearwater at Gino and Carlos with about 12 other people. It was really incredible. You could go out and the guys that used to be in Electric Flag last week are playing as Mike Bloomfield and friends in some North Beach nightclub. The people just showed up that you'd never heard of again. Like Alberto Gianquinto. I mean, Alberto was a real sad story, and he's mostly known now for Incident at Neshabar, which is his composition on Abraxas. He plays on almost all of Abraxas. He was genius, but he was an undisciplined personality, to say the least, and, you know, drug addict and all that horrible stuff. But he would just show up, and he put his fingers on the keyboard, and something really different and exciting and amazing would happen. I mean, I saw 16-year-old Neil Sean sit in with the Elvin Bishop Band. And, you know, I remember that. I was like getting hit by a freight train. That was before the Santana guys found him. And on and on. But, I mean, my stock answer to that question is that, well, I covered The Last Waltz. And I got to tell you, the movie doesn't prepare you for how great that show was. And that show was so far and away the greatest show that I was ever at. And I was at a lot of pretty big time shows, you know, Live Aid and Rock and Roll Hall of Fame opening and blah, 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 blah. But there is no second place to The Last Waltz. That was just a transcendent evening of music. And what people don't remember is that, after all the hoopla and everything, band and all those guys, everybody shows up and does I Shall Be Released with Dylan. And, you know, you'd think it was over, but no, man, the crowd wouldn't leave. And they just kept yelling and yelling and yelling. And finally, the five guys in the band come back. And they ripped that place a new one with Baby Don't Do It. And that was, to me, you know, I've just been dazzled with Clapton and Butterfield and Neil Diamond and Joni Mitchell and Neil Young and Van Morrison and man, you know. But that was the moment. 3:30 in the morning.
Now, being a music critic and having the power and the machine of the Chronicle behind you, and then engaging with these different artists, how did you tend to keep your distance? Like, how did you stay honest and stay, you know, without getting kind of sucked up into their world? And
who says I wasn't? I don't know that I wasn't. But I mean, I still wrote nasty reviews of people that I didn't think lived up to their potential. And I don't know. It was always something that they were suspicious of at the paper. And, it seemed to me like on one hand, they wanted me to be able to get Jerry Garcia on the phone if they needed a quote. And on the other hand, you know, then they get all suspicious about, are you in the Dead's pocket, Selvin? You know, there was a speaker of the assembly in Sacramento named Jess Unruh. They called him Big Daddy. And he said, talking about lobbyists, if you can't drink their booze, eat their dinners and fuck their whores and vote against them the next day, you don't have any business being up here.
And did you receive much blowback from some of these artists when you gave a negative review, or did they agree with you quite often?
There's a couple of good instances of that. I get credit for getting Grace Slick to quit the Starship.
After We Built the City, kind of the 90s?
Yeah, they had some four-night gig at a nightclub, and nobody cared at all about the Starship by that point in San Francisco. So I showed up for opening night, and there were like 30 people there. They were horrible, and they looked stupid, and the whole legacy had just been, you know, disintegrated down to a pile of ashes as far as I was concerned. I said so in the paper. Grace called up the manager and said, did you see Selvin? And he said, yeah, that motherfucker. And she said, no, he's right. And I'm not coming to the gig tonight.
Over the years, you've had, like, you just showed me some test pressings, some very early records. I'm sure you have a whole stack of promos and things in there. What sort of memorabilia did you keep? What made you decide whether you kept it or whether you moved it on?
Yeah, I got into that so late. I really, you know, it took me a long time to realize that has some kind of reflection too and some sort of library value. So not much, you know. I bought a lot of old rock and roll posters when they were still affordable. These things on the wall behind me, you know. That was like in the 80s. You know, I have files of notes and letters and stuff that had, you know, library value and stuff like that. But no, I let those things like, the, you know, the complete set of the Fillmore posters that was in my hands at one point slide through.
Yeah, I'm sure you have plenty of other stuff there. I mean, that it seems like it would be almost like a museum kind of.
It looks like a museum now. Yeah. No, a lot of old posters, a lot of, you know, gigas, and you know, what everything from, you know, bobbleheads to, you know, signed harmonicas. Somebody gave me a Sly Stone signed guitar, because, you know, you can't have a Hard Rock Cafe without a guitar on the wall. It's a Laurel, by the way, which I think is the least expensive guitar ever made.
Was it signed in modern times with Sly?
Probably, yeah, probably for like $20 or something like that. You know, it's a sort of bogus memorabilia, but you know, I'm no better than the Hard Rock that way.
Okay, what is there something in your collection or a couple of things that you think about that you're like, oh, these are just the jewels. These are my favorite bits of the collection.
I don't know that there's anything, you know, that I have much closer to than others. You know, I you know, I have a poster from Memphis with Elvis as an opening act. That's kind of cute. But people don't even notice it.
Right. Okay. Well, how about something special to you, something an artist has given you or something that you've had a moment with in your life?
Well, there's my Christmas present from Steve Miller. Does that count?
That's a nice watch. Yeah. That's.
He likes watches.
That's something you look at multiple times a day. So, yeah.
I've been had it on my wrist for about 10 years now.
With the whole recent vinyl revival of the last 10, 15 years, did that surprise you at all? What are your thoughts on that?
So, no, it didn't surprise me. In 1999, I had a cover article on the Chronicle Sunday magazine explaining to the readers what MP3s were. And that was right on time. And 4 or 5 weeks later, I did another article about where you could still buy vinyl records, because they'd been wiped out by CDs at that point. So I'd already spotted the vinyl cultism and made it into a magazine article, because I knew it wasn't going to go away, and I knew why it wasn't going to go away. I understood the deficiencies of digital sound, that you can go into great psychological realms with that. There's an Australian psychiatrist named Diamond who describes what he calls the Diamond effect, and from his point of view, listening to digital music actually transfers the hemisphere of the brain that you listen to music. It goes from intuition to intelligence, and he feels it completely has no therapeutic value. Maybe he's just a nutcase Australian psychiatrist and everything. But I did remember talking this over with John Meyer, the genius speaker manufacturer. And he said, absolutely, that MP3s keep your brain so busy solving them that they stay in the intellectual hemisphere and they do not touch the intuition.
You know what? That's something that I've spoke about before on the show, where with digital, it's not a clear sine wave. It is a series of steps, a series of samples that your brain has to do the math to smooth that out and make sense of it.
That's right.
And my theory, with no other proof or anything, is that it's somewhere in your brain, it's doing a lot of math and it's keeping you, it exhausts you probably more than anything. Because one of the things I always noticed about CDs, I knew the first 3 or 4 songs and then I didn't know anything else. And I think, because after so much time, I think I just, my brain just got exhausted and started to kind of shut down those parts.
No, nobody knew anything past track 5.
Yeah. So were you a fan of CDs when they first came out? What were your thoughts?
Sure. They were bright and shiny, and box sets were really cool. They're digging out of excavating a lot of stuff that we hadn't really seen, and mm-hmm. I liked it fine, but at the same time I realized the insufficiencies of it, and I still had like my record library, and it was a long time before I went over to 100% CD listening. In the past, since the pandemic, I'm back off CDs and on the records again.
So there wasn't a moment where you thought, okay, maybe I'm going to get rid of all these records and I'm going to go all the way CDs. You always knew that there was a difference, and you wouldn't have gotten rid of those records at that point.
So it's not the records that I would have singled out, it would have been everything. Right. So there was been, it's quite a burden to have this sizable library. And, with the internet out there, really, everybody's got most of my library in their pocket right now. So, at one point, I thought, maybe I should just like, but it wasn't like the records versus CDs. They both go. And the CDs at least had the advantage of you could rip them. And I did at one point go so far as to do a huge ripping campaign and put like, 80,000 tracks on a drive, which then subsequently crashed. I don't have any great love for digital music.
What was your reaction to Napster?
Napster was a great idea. Napster was like an appetizer tray. And people would go in and try everything. And then they'd go to the record store and buy records. I saw it happen. It happened to me. It was the record business's best friend at the right time. Unfortunately, the record business is not known for far-sighted thinking, and they saw it as this terrible enemy and stomped on it. There were so many things happening on Napster that were just beyond, like Napster was an incredible repository of old radio programs. All the old radio programs were up on Napster. And then doo-wop collectors, all those million-dollar, only three copies known to exist, doo-wop records were up on Napster. Mm-hmm. So it had this, cult appeal. Yeah, sure, everybody was downloading the Metallica records because, they wanted the Metallica records and a million sellers and all that, whatever. But it was the stuff for like you and me. It was tucked away in the corners of Napster. It was very exciting.
So in your career, you've written about gangsters. You've written about Hell's Angels. You've exposed quite a lot. Have you ever had been threatened for something that you've written? Any close calls?
Nah. Gangsters like publicity too.
Okay.
And, the Angels, man, the Angels love my book on Altamont. I'm the only guy that could let him off the hook.
Yeah.
All the gangsters in Sly's book, Hemp Banks died last year and I spoke at his friggin' funeral. So no, man, I'm okay with people. I like people. I don't judge people, in sort of obvious ways, like, oh, this guy's a criminal, Well, that's as interesting to me as if you're an ophthalmologist, maybe a little more interesting. I don't know. I don't have anything about banks that I care if you rob them or not, these guys, once they don't feel judged, then we're into journalist subject relationship that's pretty much the same all over, whether you're talking to gangsters, Hell's Angels, or what, priests or religious figures. I've interviewed them too.
but Banks, he was willing to talk. He was open about things in this book.
Nobody had ever asked him to.
Right, right. He was okay. But you've also exposed a lot of the industry practices and perhaps things people didn't want to be illuminated. So that's never caused you any trouble.
Well, look, Bill Graham and I had a contentious relationship all through my time at the Chronicle. He was under the impression that I was in his promotion department and somebody else paid my salary. I didn't see it that way. I tried to explain it to him that he was Al Davis and he owned the Raiders. And, and he didn't understand that. So we had long periods where, he wouldn't talk to me until he wanted something from me again. I've been thrown out of his shows. You can never come to my show again. Three times. So, but nothing ever came of that. That was just, paper tiger stuff. That, Bill Graham didn't carry guns. Carmine DeNoia would carry guns, man.
So did you ever make an enemy or did you make any enemies in your writing?
Well, I don't know that I did. I'm sure that I pissed people off. If I didn't, I wasn't doing my job. Enemies. Yeah, probably. I just, I don't track that very much.
You don't know who they are. Okay.
I probably do, but nothing comes to mind, but I mean, if somebody showed up that, oh yeah, that guy, I mean, the classic story is Sammy Hagar, who I've known forever, since before Ronnie Montrose knew him, joins Van Halen and comes to San Francisco on this triumphant tour as the final date. And they do four nights. And I go on the first night and I write a review. And essentially my review says, well, this ruins two perfectly otherwise very decent bands. And Sammy took tremendous umbrage and gets on the stage the next night and tells everybody to call me and give me hell and hands out what he thinks is my home phone number. So I come home and there's all these phone messages. And the first one is some guy saying, you know, Mr. Sullivan, I have your old home phone number in Oakland. Could you please give your friends and business associates your new home phone number? That's weird. Next. Joel, it's Roger from Bill Graham Presents. Sammy Hagar gave you a number out at this Cow Palace last night. You might be getting a few calls. Then beep. Fuck you, you motherfucker. And that went on for weeks, you know. And I mean, I changed my message saying, Sammy Hagar fan club, leave your message. But that didn't really abate. Anyway, so the time comes at the Bay Area Music Awards.
The Bammies. Yes.
And they have this, you know, hospitality area where you have to have a sticker pass to get into. But their sticker passes are easy to get. So the place is just ass to elbow, right? And I'm trying to get out of there, pushing my way through the crowd. And Sammy sees me. And he starts yelling, Joel! Hey, Joel! Joel! Excuse me. Joel, hey, I need your new home phone number.
Fast forward a decade or so, and you're writing a book with him.
Yeah. It was the number one bestseller. You know, I still get royalties from that book. I'm very grateful to Sammy for that.
Okay, so when you're working with someone like Sammy Hagar on his book, and he's telling a story, maybe embellishing it a little bit, and you're thinking in your head, oh, I don't know about this. Do you call him on bullshit?
Wait a second. Sammy, in his book, recounts being abducted by aliens.
Mm-hmm.
He acted it out on the Jimmy Fallon show. I sat home and watched that on TV and went, what a co-author. Wow. Yes. I mean, telling you about being abducted by aliens, my big toe shot of my boot, man, this is going to be nuts in the book. I'm not responsible for content. Okay. You know, I'm the co-author. He's the author. If he wants to tell him about being abducted by aliens, I'm going to make sure that his verb tenses are right and that the sentences make sense and, you know, that it all lays flat on the page.
Okay.
And let's go ahead and do it. I mean, you know, he's, at one point in that book, he says that he slept with 75 women a week when he was with Van Halen. I don't think slept was the right word, but you know right. What I mean. And you don't want to do the math on that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, 10 minutes per gal, seven of them a day. You know, no, it doesn't work, Sammy. You know, you have to stay up all night and you can't do anything else but, you know, have sex. So. Mm-hmm. 75 women. No, I don't think so. And then his wife calls me just before the book's going to be published. You know, she hasn't seen any of it.
Oh, no,
she's freaked out. She says, Joel, the PTA. Carrie, what can I say? You know, it's your husband, not mine.
So that's in contrast to something like Sly and the Family Stone book, which is directly the words you're not shaping any of the words of the people who you spoke with. And to me,
that was the assignment,
but it was from you. It was your authorship.
No. Okay. That was a part of a series of books that were dreamed up, by Dave Marsh, who was dreamed up by Dave Marsh's agent. Dave was, dealing with a severe writer's block after the, death of his 21-year-old daughter from cancer. And his agent thought, well, maybe oral history he could do, you know, because that'd just be talking and transcripts. And then she sold it as a series of oral histories that Dave would edit. And he called up and offered me the Sly and the Family Stone. I took it immediately. Yeah, man, I know. And I kind of overachieved. The other people didn't do anywhere near as much work on their books or travel as much or spend as much money. You got Lynyrd Skynyrd and the Women of Motown and Black Sabbath. They're all supposed to be corners of the rock world that hadn't been over covered. And Dave did Sam and Dave, which at that point was just Sam. Mm-hmm. I interviewed more than 40 people. I traveled to Hawaii, Los Angeles. I was all over the place, you know, picking this stuff up first person, face to face, if I could. Just became obsessed with this as the story became more and more vivid. And I'm telling you, it started out with talking to the guys in the band, and like most survivors of traumatic episodes, they have a story. It's down. That's the story they tell. So I collected that story, and then I met Hamp. And meeting Hamp Banks wasn't all that easy. I mean, I really had to go find the guy. But once I did, he was totally into this. Nobody had ever asked him. And he was not only willing to tell me everything he knew, he was getting this guy and that guy and this guy and that guy to talk to me. And nobody had ever talked to those guys either. So then I get this whole other side of the story, and I go back to the band and go, wait a minute, you guys told me this fairy tale. What about what Hamp says? And they all changed the story. All of them. I remember Gregorico, the drummer, telling me, yeah. One thing about Hamp, he's no bullshitter. And that's the truth. Hamp's a righteous dude. He's a living, well, not anymore, but he was the walking, talking life proof of that Bob Dylan line that to live outside the law, you must be honest. And I told him at one point, I said, you live by a code, don't you? And he said, I try to. And absolutely, he did. So he was a remarkable guy. And his contribution to that book was just so enormous, I can't tell you. He not only told me his story and brought up all these other guys like Womack and Eddie Chin and JB and cats like that, but he once everybody knew that I'd been talking to him, they had to deal with me on a different level. And in fact, Rose, Sly's sister, once she found out I was dealing with Hamp, she wouldn't have anything to do with me because she knew that I had the story.
It sounds like.
And I don't know. Are we sensitive about language here?
No, not at all.
Okay. So what Hamp told me was he said that, he says, you're the ringmaster now. Jerry Martini, his head hurts. He's trying so hard to remember what he told you. And Rose selling her pussy out of both sides of drawers.
So Hemp sounds like quite the character.
He was a community leader. I mean, and that's not an unusual position for a pimp / hairdresser in the black community, especially from his era. Right. His funeral earlier this year was attended by 700 people. They had a procession down the Fillmore with a horse-drawn carriage. It was like the mayor had died.
Like a state funeral. It's interesting because I guess the way I read that is that Hemp still controlled the story, controlled part of these people's lives years, decades afterward.
Hadn't talked to him. They hadn't seen him. They didn't know where he was.
But they were scared to reveal something that maybe they shouldn't have.
It's like everybody that has a traumatic experience. You sanitize it in your mind because that's how you deal with it. And this was a traumatic experience belonging to Sly and the Family Stone.
Yeah.
Now, Hamp was not traumatized. He was one of the traumatizers. But he was not traumatized. He knew what bullshit Sly was, and he didn't do all the drugs, some of them. But somehow Hamp walked through that fire without getting burned. Everybody else just covered in scorch marks.
But for example, you have Gregorico, who had this one story, you went to hemp, you found a different set of facts or an additional set of facts. You come back to Greg and he's, oh, was it opening doors he hadn't thought of in years? Or was it like he knew it, he didn't share it until he knew it was okay to share it?
I don't know if he thought it was okay. You know, I remember Greg coming over the second time. Talking about the pool house he was living in on Coldwater Canyon and how it was just horrible and how what conditions he was living under. And, you know, he left during the recording of Riot going on. He just stopped mm-hmm. going down there. And we sat around that afternoon and played Riot going on so that he could show me where his drums are.
Oh, okay.
Because there aren't very much of them on there.
Most of it's drum machine, I think, yeah?
Most of it's drum machine, and the most of the stuff that isn't is Sly playing drums.
Now, Riot going on, that's a pretty noisy album. Like, and for Sly, who has come from a production background, you know, spent time in radio, had a bunch of hits up until that point, for him to be able to turn out something like Riot going on with the sound quality it had was really surprising. What were your thoughts? What research came up on why that was?
We'll be back after these messages.
Hey everyone, I'm here to talk to you about Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Ever find a record in a used bin where the vinyl is gorgeous, but the sleeve has this ugly split and is even falling completely apart? Well, that's okay. Grab it anyway, because with Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips, you can fix that right up. Seems Easy record repair strips repair seam splits from the inside, so it doesn't affect the appearance of a record sleeve, but it does make it functional again. With Seems Easy, records can now slide in and out like new. Turn a $5 used record into a $50 functioning collectible. Just ask your local record shop for Seems Easy strips, and if they're not in stock, go to seamseasy.com. That's Seems Easy with two Z's. Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Seems easy because it is. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE. 10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits. Riot going on, that's a pretty noisy album. Like, and for Sly, who has come from a production background, you know, spent time in radio, had a bunch of hits up until that point, for him to be able to turn out something like Riot going on with the sound quality it had was really surprising. What were your thoughts? What research came up on why that was?
Well, that album was recorded under the most extreme chaotic conditions imaginable in an attic that was reached through a secret passageway in Jeanette McDonald's old Beverly Hills house across the street from where they filmed Beverly Hillbillies. So it was just couldn't have been stranger. John and Michelle Phillips had lived there before Sly, and Sly rented it from them. Massive amounts of drugs, no clocks, no time. Day and night went by. Cast of characters of 1,000. Everybody from Ike Turner, Billy Preston, Miles Davis, Bobby Womack, a country singer named Jim Ford was part of all that scene. There are a bunch of people involved that you never heard of. And they come in and out, and the tapes would come in and out, and the tapes would have this part on it, and then it'd be edited into that part. And nobody ever knew what was going on, even Sly. And it took a year and a half to get the record produced. And when it was kind of sort of a minimalist sound on most of the tracks, although then there's that 9-minute version of Thank You for Letting Me Be Myself Again that's pretty much band tracks. That's where Greg's drums are heard.
Right.
And I mean, the big hit, Family Affair, that's Rose, Billy Preston, and Sly, and a drum machine.
Okay.
There's nobody else from the band anywhere near it.
The tapes from that time, actually the tapes of Sly's career, like what has happened? What has become of those? Is there a stash of those tapes? Are they hidden in an archive somewhere? Are there?
My understanding is that Columbia Records does not have a particularly good holding of the Sly and the Family Stone tapes. I know when they put out the reissue series and were looking for bonus tracks, I sent them to some Sly Stone collector who had some pretty peculiar tapes. I have some Sly Stone tapes that Michael Carabello from Santana brought me. He wanted me to digitize them for him. And, you know, he plays congas on a little bit of it. And Sly gave him the tape so he could learn the part. And it's Thank You for Letting Me Be Myself Again. It's about 16 minutes long. It's got like three instruments on it. I'm not really sure what it is. But this was the reel he gave Carabello to learn the song so that he could play congas on it. So obviously Sly had this thing of like splitting up tapes, putting parts on different tapes. And, you know, from what I gather, his tape library system involved when he was working up the record plant in Sausalito was he would load up the station wagon with his tapes every day and take them when he went. And then when he'd come back, he'd load them out again. So, I mean, the guy had no inventory control whatsoever. Everybody was on drugs, and it was just a complete reckless episode ongoing forever. It was a riot. That's what the album was about. So, no, I don't think there's a lot of outtakes up there.
Okay. Any Sly material that we know about that is difficult to find? Or, for example, he put a lot of singles out in the early 60s around Vallejo. Is there anything that's particularly difficult to come across? Or
there's a bunch of those things, you know, like the Stewart Brothers and Danny Stewart record. And Sly had been making records since like about 1960. Yeah, a lot of, you know, this thing and that thing. Nothing very good, by the way. The Viscaines thing's okay. Sort of a latter era doo-wop record. Mm-hmm. And that's all been unearthed on CD. Alec Palau is researcher, archivist, musician who has pretty much done the San Francisco music scene as far as tapes go. He's responsible for that 4-CD box set, Love Is But a Song We Sing on Rhino. And He's done a couple hundred CD reissues. And some of his Sly stuff is some of his best. He did a CD of all the Stoneflower stuff, which was independent productions that Sly did while he was living in Bel Air and making this Riot Going On record with like Mighty Joe Hicks and Little Sister. And that's really strong stuff, really good material. And then he did an album, a CD of all the early Autumn Records stuff. And a lot of that's unreleased because the Autumn record tapes all survived. You know, Donahue sold them to Warner Brothers, and Warner Brothers has a very good inventory system. So he dug up this whole CD of, you know, like unreleased Sly. And the first night Hamp is over here, he's looking and he sees this CD of Sly, Diamond in the Rough, I think it's called. And he looks and he goes, Only Dogs Will Have a Day. That's one of my favorites. And he proceeds to recite the lyrics to this unreleased 1964 Sly Stone song on a map. This guy's the real deal.
Wow. I was particularly fascinated with the first record, the Stewart Four.
In the Battlefield of the Lord. Yeah, that's a real hard one to find. That one, you know, I've seen it. Somebody showed me a copy of it once, but I mean, what do you think? You think they pressed 500 copies of that?
I've heard it's under 100, and the fact that we could actually even listen to it in any way is a bit of a miracle. What's the story on that? Do you know much about the background of that
that record?
Sure, yeah. Well, you know, the family was very dedicated to Jehovah's Witness. And they bounced back and forth between Fort Worth, Dallas area and Vallejo. And it was completely in the church deal. So they had this family thing. Loretta, the older sister, played piano. Sylvester, Freddie, Rose, but not Veda. She was too young. But they were all like 7 to 12, right in that range. They were popular performers at these two churches back and forth. And the record was made in Texas by the church down there. I don't know that it had any life of its own outside of that church.
No, probably, yeah. I would imagine the only copies that still exist are the ones that were actually owned by the family.
And that's I knew Loretta to have one. And I knew a record collector that found one.
Right. To me, I guess that would be the hardest Sly Stone record to locate, unless you know of something else that's even more.
No, that's the
Grail.
Yeah, the Grail. Yeah.
Did you ever have a chance to speak with Sly before or after the book?
So I had a couple of phone meetings with Sly while he was in rehab because there was some thought that he would do a autobiography. Mm-hmm. And I was set up to talk to him about working with him on his autobiography, which, by the way, is coming out now.
Oh, okay.
He did worked with Ben Greenman, who did the George Clinton and the Brian Wilson, is really a brilliant writer who did a piece of fiction that was inspired by my Sly and the Family Stone oral history.
Okay.
So Ben's the guy, and it's coming out, I guess, later this year or early next year.
Okay. All right. Do you have any other information other than
somebody in the publisher's company reached out to me about researching photos. So it's in production. It's already been done. I exchanged a couple emails with Ben after hearing from the publishing company.
Okay.
And then Questlove is said to be working on a documentary.
Oh, okay. But you'd had conversations with Sly beforehand about this.
I never talked to him or approached him about doing the book.
Could you find him when you were originally doing the book in 98? Could you even find him? Did you know where he was at?
Did I know where he was at? Kind of. I could have found him, but I cared not to. As I said, you know, what is he going to say? Yeah, I did all that stuff.
I think that's the right decision because for me, rock books, I don't like autobiographies. I like biographies. I like it when it's told by the people around them, which is the way this book is made.
Here's the hole in the donut.
Yeah, yeah.
It feels right to me because I don't think he'd be as honest as those other people were.
Of course not. So you decided to kind of leave him out and not pursue him that much.
No, I didn't seek him at all.
Okay.
There had been a bunch of that, you know. There were these filmmakers from Holland that were trying to find him, and there was this guy from Vibe magazine that went on a big campaign to find Sly, and, you know, he wasn't so hard to find as all that, although he did have a period of time where he was eluding the FBI and living as a fugitive from justice.
It's got to be one of the most heartbreaking stories in rock history. Would you agree with that?
Well, I don't know about heartbreaking. It's certainly tragic. Sly abused everything that was given him, all the love, all the talent, all the success, almost purposefully abused it to see what he, you know, if he, how fast and how completely he could destroy all that stuff. So, it's an incredible sort of story of character and the demolition of character. The people that talk about the young Sly Stone that say produced the Bo Grummels records, just they sound like they're talking about a different person from the guy who played Woodstock.
It just strikes me that here's this guy, I mean, really kind of a proto type Prince level of musicianship. He self-destructed in a semi-public way. If it had ended in the early 70s, his poster would be next to the Jim Morrisons and the Jimi Hendrixes, right? I mean, to me, it just seems like this long, slow flame out has really destroyed any sort of semblance of a legacy.
You know, when I did the book in 95, their reputation was at a low ebb. And the band members and associates were kind of surprised that I was there asking the questions. They had some enthusiasm level because of just that. And it's been a slow process for that to be restored, right? I guess the cherry on the top of that was Questlove's Summer of Soul thing, where they really take the honors on that movie. Yeah, they all remember playing it too. It wasn't a happy day for them. No. They didn't have that many happy days after a while, you know? It got really, really dark, really fast for them.
I recognize that when reading the book, it was like, wait, all this stuff is happening within the course of about 24 months.
Yeah.
Oh, well, Joel, look, you know, you've shared a lot. This book is absolutely tremendous. I'm so glad to see it back in print. Sly and the Family Stone, an oral history. It's on paperback and it's on Kindle. I mean, the stories, not just the music, the drugs, the guns, the Dick Cavett show, the dogs.
Well, the Dick Cavett show is up on YouTube. That's something. That's a thing, a beauty all by itself.
But the background of the Dick Cavett show is what's in your book. I mean,
Oh yeah. Well, once you know the background, then, but you know, and I'm also really glad to have a great cover finally. The other one was a crappy cover. This is great. So things are good. I'm happy to have it back out. It's a terrific piece of work. I'm really proud of being the vehicle by which these people were able to express themselves, because it's their book and it's their eloquence that really make it the book so chilling. There's an article I did for the Mojo magazine about the making of the riot going on using some of the interviews, but I wrote it, right? You know, like a third person thing. That's not as good.
Well, I guess a lot of these people that you interviewed for the book, not only Hamp, but I'm sure a handful of others are no longer around. They can't tell their story. This is the last chance that they're going to have.
Yeah, David Kaplan, you know, died in 2017 at 93. No. And the last thing I saw of David was him in a tie-dye caftan, laughing his ass off, standing next to his casket in a photo on Facebook.
Oh, what a character. That's amazing. So, again, I want to recommend people check out this Sly and the Family Stone, an oral history. Without this sort of research, any sort of biography, autobiography, any sort of documentary would be incomplete without this sort of color, this sort of detail that has to be discussed, has to be contended with, because you were able to locate it when no one else could.
The people that I spoke with were just consistently brave and honest and anxious to have this story told. And worked hard to see that it was fully told. So, you know, I think about people like Stephanie Swanigan, who you know, stepped into that and out of that, and you know, has lived an impeccable life ever since. She works for legislators in Sacramento, and it's just a, you know, fan. And I sat in her house, and you know, she recalled this like 18 months or 24 months of the nightmare of her life with just grace and candor. And there it is, you know, for everybody to see. I'm real impressed with them. And just as I am the gangsters like Eddie Chin, who were so, I mean, they were as enthusiastic about this as anybody trying to, you know, do an interview to get their record on the radio. I mean, they were just great. So I mean, in many ways, it's their book and, you know, that I was able to collect this and put it together. I feel like sort of like the executive producer of this thing. And like I say, I can feel really proud about it because my mistakes aren't in there. My other books are filled with my mistakes.
Oh, that's a great way to end it. Joel, thank you so much for coming on the Vinyl Guide, mate. And let's schedule another time, maybe early next year. We'll do a little bit more of a deep dive on those records behind you.
Done, and done. Thanks so much.
Okay, take care, mate. Cheers. There he is, Mr. Joel Selvin. I want to send my appreciation for coming on the show. And that Sly and the Family Stone book, boy, that is, that's crazy, man. Joel's a great writer. I've read some of his other books on Altamont, Haight-Ashbury. He knows how to string together a sentence, man. So highly recommend this Sly and the Family Stone, an oral history book. And don't forget, if you enjoyed this interview, we've got more of it, an extended version up at patreon.com/vinylguide. Help support the show. You get all the extras. You get early access to interviews, extended interviews, high-resolution files, all commercial-free at patreon.com/vinylguide. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media. Put them on Facebook, tweet them out on Twitter. Share them in the Facebook groups. Talk to your friends about the Vinyl Guide. Show them how to get a podcast on the smartphone of theirs. It's not always that intuitive. They can use your help. They'll appreciate it, and so will I. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some music, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.